Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know it. It's our regular thing. Every day we begin with the words of Colonel Vindman as he testified before the impeachment hearing in November of 2019. His words were powerful. They were emotional. They were patriotic. And he did the right thing, which is why he was so hurt. Because under Donald Trump, to do the right thing is probably to lose your job or probably be escorted out of the White House. So now we hear the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
No, it's not all right. I know, Colonel Vindman, it's not all right. So before we begin to introduce my guest, you know that we tape this show the day before because everything's happening remote. We're doing it by Zoom. So in order for us to accommodate the sort of craziness of our lives, we have to do things in a way that are not exactly timely. And I'm going to apologize to my guest because we did not realize that just before she came on, Bernie Sanders would do what a lot of people have been waiting for him to do to some extent. And that is he basically announced that he was suspending his campaign. It doesn't mean that he's not going to still want to collect votes and he's going to want to have some kind of an influence in the Democratic convention, but he basically passed the torch to Joe Biden. And so I'm going to ask Grace Getty, who is an editor at the Washington Monthly, to at least forgive me. So before we get into this remarkable series at the Washington Monthly, I want to read you a note that I got from a Republican operative, my response to the Republican operative, and why the series at the Washington Monthly came in so handy at this moment. All right. So here's what he sent me. He said, "Will you be voting for Joe Biden, Arnie? How do your friends, listeners feel about his decision? Have you seen the grumpy reaction to his decision to keep his name on the ballot and influence the convention? Is there a coronavirus aspect to all this? Thank you, as always, for your wisdom and insight." Gag me. Anyway, so I immediately did a stream of consciousness response. Lucky you, Grace, you get to hear it. Mm-hmm. And here's what I wrote. I wrote, "Voting for Joe? Of course. Our democracy is on the line. The world is horrified by what we have become. I am horrified by the cruelty and vindictiveness of Trump, but more appalled by, quote, his party that has lost all connection to truth, science, the rule of law, the value of the franchise, and the idea that the health and safety of their citizens matter. I am voting for Joe because it is a vote for me and for my children's future. I will fight for change like I have never fought before. The pandemic hasn't changed anything, except it has exposed the weakness of our democracy, of our public institutions, and proves on a daily basis why good government matters, parentheses, a government that values merit, insists on transparency, fights inequality, and deserves public trust," close quote. So that was my literally stream of consciousness response to that note, Grace. Mm-hmm. And then I posted it on Facebook, okay? And so as soon as I posted on Facebook, a lot of my fanatical Bernie supporters were like, "Oh, I don't know. I won't decide yet. I can't tell whether I want Biden." I mean, they were like, it was just so over the top. And so as I'm reading this stuff, I'm like wanting to gag, like as if there was a choice. And look, Biden is a great disappointment to me too. Trust me. But as I pointed out, Joe Biden tends to lead from behind, which is in this case, not a bad idea, as long as I'm the one that's sort of like in front of him or pushing him or whatever. Because I think in a lot of ways, even if you looked at his agenda from Barack Obama's, it's more progressive. But as they were sort of lamenting that, you know, Bernie had dropped out or has at least suspended his campaign, guess what I did? I went to the Washington Monthly and I said, so you don't know what to do in November of 2020? Let me give you this. And what I did was why you are here. I sent them the series from Washington Monthly, which I have to tell you, Grace, was incredibly hard to read. Not that it wasn't well written. It was just so terribly frightening. And the title of the series at the Washington Monthly is What If Trump Wins? Imagining the consequences of a second term. And then what you did was you went to a series of different writers, for everyone from Wesley Clark to David Cole to Julie Rovner, and you said to them, write what you know from your area of expertise and tell us to project what would happen. And I'm inviting you to this program to sort of give us an overview of why you chose who you chose to write, what they were writing about, and maybe even a little nugget from each one of these articles. And I posted it and I said to people, read this. Because whether you care about diplomacy, whether you care about healthcare, whether you care about immigration, this is something for everyone. And by the time they get done focusing on their area of concern, I think they have direction for what they will do in November of 2020. So welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your kind words about our latest package. And thank you for having me on. Yes. So we put out this magazine just a couple of days ago. And I think it's really timely as we're all realizing how important it is to think ahead and think about potential future consequences and important decisions. So like you mentioned, we had a variety of experts and seasoned reporters think through on different policy areas what might happen, what the specifics of what a second Trump administration might try to do. And there are a few themes that emerged. One theme is just how important his actions have been with judicial appointments so far and how much more could happen in a second term. You know, so much is in the power of district judges, federal judges, Supreme Court judges. And with a lot of the things he's tried to do in his first term, they've been momentarily blocked by federal judges, but he's appointed judges so rapidly and will likely continue to do so into a second term that a lot of those executive orders we could see greenlit. And also when you think about who sits on the Supreme Court, we have some very elderly folks on the liberal side, specifically Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And it seems likely that if he were elected for another 4 years, one of those justices could pass away and he would get another Supreme Court pick. And if that happens, it could have a whole series of consequences.
So one of the things I noticed, you're right, almost everyone, whether they were talking about from a diplomacy perspective or an immigration perspective or a healthcare perspective, the judge thing seeped into their response, which it tells you that Democrats have never quite appreciated the judicial bench the way Republicans have. The Republicans understood if they were going to be successful, that it was the courts where they needed to sort of make sure that they sort of put their sword in the ground. And it's interesting because as you mentioned, the fact that the bench was so important, we just had a fellow on the air, Mark Stern from Slate.com. And he was talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which is an elected Supreme Court, unlike the appointed Supreme Court, but, you know, nothing else. They both work for Republicans, whether it's, you know, it turns out the Trump appointees or who got elected in Wisconsin. But one of the things he said, which was so interesting, and again, it just points to how we have to focus on the bench. He said the Koch brothers decided that they were going to have their petri dish be Wisconsin. And what they knew they needed to do was they needed to control the Supreme Court in Wisconsin. And you can see the consequences of that with the decision to have that election on Tuesday. You can also see the consequences of Donald Trump when it comes to the election on Tuesday, because he has a 5-4 majority on the United States Supreme Court. And of course, I will tell you that I thought that perhaps Justice Roberts, who is now our swing, oy vey, might not have sided with the other four very conservative justices, but for whatever reason, he went along with them. If that's the case, if he got one more justice, then Roberts would have absolutely no meaning and would not ever be able to sway the bench, because whoever he appointed would probably be very young and an uber conservative. What I thought was interesting in one of the articles was that there was a quote, and I don't know if this is true, but it was from a White House press release. And I don't know if I can trust White House press releases, but it goes directly to your comment about judges. And what it said in this White House press release is that approximately one out of every four active judges on the United States Court of Appeals has been appointed by President Trump. One out of every four. And what I think people don't understand is those are many Supreme Courts. You know, everyone looks at the Supreme Court as if, but only a handful of cases ever get to them. Most of the cases actually be heard by a court of appeals if they're appealed. Certainly. And that number is just staggering.
Yeah, I think you got at something interesting there when you mentioned that conservatives have been really laser focused on the court and understand its importance. Not only has Trump been focused on this, but this has also been a long-term Mitch McConnell project. And I think it is the case that Democrats, to some extent, took their eye off the ball of the courts, because for a few decades, there was a liberal majority on the court, and it was kind of seen as a place that would often swing in liberals' favor. And during that period, that's when conservatives really started to focus on it and realize they need to win over more seats. And they built things like the Federalist Society, and important Republicans made it a priority for them, like you mentioned. And now we're really seeing the effects of that. So yeah, if Trump gets to nominate another Supreme Court judge, we could see things like states being allowed to add work requirements to Medicare. We'd almost definitely see abortion rights completely eroded. We'd see the court become more pro-business. You know, we had David Cole, the legal director of the ACLU, write on what might happen to civil rights and civil liberties. And a lot of what he said is, you know, what might happen if the Supreme Court gets another conservative justice. He also predicted that it would kind of mean the end of affirmative action, kind of the end of advancing LGBTQ equality through the courts, and likely a radical expansion of gun rights and religious rights.
So as these folks were being asked to write their piece, you went to Harold Pollack about healthcare. And I actually know Harold. I've interviewed him a couple of times. A couple of things that were interesting about what he said. He said, Obamacare won't be repealed. It will just rust away. Given the nature of this pandemic, and given the nature of what we now see with a public health system that basically never really existed, it was already kind of starving before this. And we're recognizing that, you know, people are suddenly going, I don't want to have healthcare connected to work. Do you think that the push to repeal Obamacare, or that the push to sort of undermine the health structure in the United States, will be as much front and center in the second term of Donald Trump? Or will the pandemic have slightly sobered him up, or at least taken away some of the enthusiasm to somehow suggest that the current private healthcare system is just fine and dandy and you love it?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, thinking through how this now sudden widespread attentiveness to who gets care and what's the quality of your personal care will affect the politics of healthcare. I think there are still a whole lot of Republican voters out there who don't like the sound of Obamacare, but do like some of the protections it affords them, whether or not they connect those protections to the name of the law itself. But I do think the fact that everyone's coming into contact with, you know, really needing healthcare, I think it will have ramifications for conversations around healthcare policy. The other thing I'll say is, even coronavirus aside, there's been a major kind of Overton window shift on the Democratic side in terms of what's even being discussed about as viable ideas. You know, Joe Biden, the moderate candidate, is proposing a healthcare plan that would have been seen as extremely progressive just 6-8 years ago. Right. And the proposal of Medicare for All, while it's kind of received differently within the Democratic Party has kind of shifted the overall healthcare policy to debate to become way more progressive and centering government provided care in a way that wasn't the case in the past.
Well, and people are now, I mean, even Joe Biden used this word, I mean, be still my heart. He said that healthcare should be a right. Excuse me? That's a Bernie Sanders word. That wasn't right. A joke. And actually, when you hear Donald Trump talking about healthcare, though he knows more than the doctors, and you know he acts like a doctor during his pressers, but if nothing else, he even uses some of the words too, right. The progressives on healthcare. So it's going to be fascinating to see how it fleshes out. Definitely, I think between what Bernie did and the pandemic, you've got an interesting sort of mix that are making people rethink their relationship to the healthcare system and how vulnerable they want to be. Let's go to the immigration story.
Sure.
Because the immigration story is fascinating. What they basically suggest is that we're going to see a wall. We're not going to see a fence. It's going to be this glorious wall. There's going to be a tremendous push to make sure that, you know, people in Latin America stay in Latin America and don't come through here. And there's one of the other aspects of the pandemic, and it was not written in your article about immigration, was that I think Donald Trump thinks he only wants people from Norway to come, or people that are like smart and white and have like big, huge checks with commas in them and wouldn't care if they're like from Saudi Arabia or China, as long as they come with lots of money and just an investment idea, not that they would be needed for anything else. The pandemic has actually also shown us our connection to a group of very vulnerable workers, which are the pickers, the people that pick our crops. The people that work in where they butcher the pigs in Iowa, whatever. I am wondering whether the pandemic is also an opportunity to sort of make even Donald Trump rethink some of his irrational immigration policy, because he's going to need them to work at Mar-a-Lago too.
Right. I think that's an interesting question. I mean, I think this is so central to his entire candidacy that I'd be very kind of surprised if he starts taking a different tone on immigration. You know, the work that overwhelmingly immigrants do has always been vital to the American economy. And of course, it's more obvious now that we're kind of defining who and what is essential work, and we're overwhelmingly reliant on it. But that being said, it's such a core part of how he appeals to his base that I'd be very surprised if he changes his tone on immigration, be it illegal or legal.
I think you're right. But I think now, as we're beginning to realize, grocery stores don't grow the food. You know, they can only put on the shelves what comes through the system. And I think this is also an opportunity to also challenge his immigration policy in a way we've never had before. These were the invisible people. We didn't care about them. So he could say that they're all, you know, murderers and rapists and whatever, but all of a sudden we're going to find out that those murderers and rapists, actually the reason why you have strawberries and the reason why you have artichokes and the reason why, it's like from all those people who you think you don't like, but you essentially need. So I think in an interesting way, the pandemic may also begin to help us frame or put him into a box where, you know, before he was unleashed to be so horrific on immigration policy. And now we're suddenly going to realize that immigration policy is actually intimate to everything we do in a way that I think we didn't know before.
I hope you're right about that. I mean, I think one of the other factors that drive Trump supporters to want to kind of adhere to his immigration rhetoric is their own economic insecurity, which is a real factor. And I fear that this coming economic recession or depression that comes along with coronavirus will make people, you know, even more economically unstable and worried about protecting their own jobs and resources and clan. And so I think it has the potential to cut both ways.
Exactly. So before I let you go, there was two other things that I found fascinating. And one was under your labor piece. And, you know, in a way, labor has kind of shrunk in its influence, which is a sad commentary. And it used to be very important. And according to this article, what he's done to the federal labor unions is just unconscionable. I found this quote really remarkable. And that was talking about that Trump's National Labor Relations Board has been kept busy, handing down a spate of decisions that align with employer interests and overturn Obama-era decisions. This is the kicker. In early 2017, the Chamber of Commerce, a powerful business lobby, published a wish list of 10 policies it wanted to see changed under the Trump administration. In less than 3 years, ladies and gentlemen, this is my addition, the NLRB addressed all 10 items on the list, even going beyond what the lobby requested in some instances. This is shocking. This is shocking. The reason why this is such a great series is that you kind of knew, but they get deeper into the weeds about what he has already done. So as they forecast where he is going, you're even more depressed because you didn't realize the extent to what he had dismantled. I mean, we kind of are aware generically what each one of these segments has done is talked about what's happened in Europe, what's happened in Africa, what's happened with healthcare, what's happened with immigration, what's happened with labor. You've been so focused on his tweet storm. You've been so focused on his vindictiveness. You're so scared now because of the pandemic that this series has tremendous value because these are the things you may have missed.
Well, thank you for that. And that piece is written by a brilliant freelance writer, Rachel Cohen, who writes a lot about labor issues as well as some other issues. But yeah, I think this question of what will happen to labor is an important one. And like you mentioned, sometimes flies under the radar, but he has actually gotten a whole lot done in terms of conservative goals when it comes to labor in his first term. And I think labor is especially an area where we can expect to continue to feel the effects of those decisions in the years to come. A lot of what governs what worker circumstances are like when they have union representation are all these little laws about when they're able to gather, whether their union rep has a right to an office. And
right.
Those are the sort of decisions where when they're reversed, the impact isn't immediately clear, but they definitely wear down the strength of unions over time. And so I think these changes he's been able to make on labor will continue to feel the effects for years to come.
Before I let you go, the last one was from Paul Glastras. He's the upbeat one. Why a second Trump term will not be a horror movie. Yeah, I know he's writing his own movie script. So I don't know if I agree with him. One of the things he pointed out was Donald Trump was not really effective in passing legislation. He used executive orders left and right. He used intimidation left and right. He asked people to leave the administration as a way to not enforce things. So I think to a large extent, what I gathered from what Paul was saying was that because it's an executive order, it can change immediately. If you make change in 2020 and it's not Donald Trump, a lot of the damage he has done, while there will be a little bit of permanence to it, you actually can rehabilitate it pretty quickly. Is that a pretty accurate representation of what Paul said?
I think that's one part of it. And his other part is that if you look at what happens to presidents in their second term, there's actually kind of a pattern of them being greatly diminished in terms of their power. Presidents tend to kind of make missteps and have their popularity wane during their second term. If you think about, say, President George W. Bush, at the beginning of his term, he had really high levels of support among conservatives, much like Trump does now. But then a series of events, how he handled Hurricane Katrina, his effort to privatize Social Security, a few other things really diminished his popularity. And so Paul, our editor-in-chief, is kind of pointing out these different historical facts and saying, look, even if Trump wins second term, here's why second-term presidencies tend to be less influential.
Okay, so let me just say something. So you can tell Paul that Arnie said this, okay? And Arnie said, that's true historically with the old Republican Party. This is now a cult. And the problem with a cult is that even though he may not be able to run again, although I'm not even sure that he's not going to try, is that everybody's going to want to be the son of the cult. So they're going to want to sort of be the seal of Trump. And that means while normally you would begin to see people beginning to sort of say, okay, I want to be the next candidate for president on the GOP side, they're going to want to be more like Donald than they're going to want to be like Republicans. And I think that's the concern. So what you say about Bush was the old Republican Party. This is the Trump Republican Party. And I think the old playbook may not be playing out. But on that note, Grace Getty, thank you so much for joining us. It was an amazing series at the Washington Monthly. Perfect timing as Bernie decides that he's going to suspend his campaign and people are trying to figure out whether they want Biden or Trump. Trust me, read this. It is a horror movie. Take care. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much as well.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone, we're going to be doing Current Cast next. And then when we come back, Bob Hennelly is going to be talking to us about what's happening to the public sector in New York City during the time of the pandemic. We'll be right back.
The magic of permeable pavement on this Current Cast. Now you see it, now you don't. Rain that usually pools on hard surfaces seems to just disappear instead of running off and washing waste and debris into storm drains and waterways. But it's no illusion. The stormwater is actually seeping through small pores in the pavement and soaking slowly into the ground. In the process, pollutants are filtered out or consumed by organisms in the soil. Called permeable pavement, these porous substances can make attractive and functional patios, driveways, and parking lots. Some look like paved brick or cobblestone, others like conventional concrete, but all have one thing in common. When it comes to reducing runoff, they do the trick. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Why can't you just tell me the truth? Hard to believe the things you say. Why can't you feel the tears I cry today, cry today, cry today? How do you win if we all lose? You change the facts to justify. Your lips move, but your words get in the way, in the way, in the way. Kings and queens, crooks and thieves, you don't see the forest for the trees. Head and heart on our knees, you can see what we all see. How do you sleep?
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. He's joined us on many occasions because he is on the cutting edge of everything that is happening, especially in places like New York City and New Jersey. We're being joined by Robert Hennelly, affectionately known as Bob. He writes for Salon.com. He writes for The Chief Leader. He is at Stuck Nation. And more importantly, because he is covering the public sector workers in New York for Chief Leader, he really does know all the stories that don't necessarily make the headlines, make CNN, make MSNBC, and maybe they're the more important stories because they're the stories that tell you what's really happening in places like New York and around the country. So let me welcome to the program, Bob Hennelly.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. You sent me something at about 2:30 today, and it was entitled, Hiding the Scale and Scope of the Pandemic to Manufacture Back to Work Consensus. So who's hiding the scale and scope, and what do you mean by that?
It is a very provocative, of course, but the reality is there's a confluence of things happening here that we have to unpack very carefully because so much depends on it.
Okay.
There is the way that Governor Cuomo is exerting great leadership. The question is, what is he pursuing, and what do those daily briefings that so much of America relies on to get a sense of the situational awareness? And what I mean by that is the broad scope of things. We can't go out like we used to, or if we're working as an essential worker out there in the workplace, we see just a small fraction because all of our mobility is limited by our crisis. Mm-hmm. Right. And so he is managing the facilities of the hospitals, and God bless him. It is a wonderful thing. That is not the same thing as dealing with the challenges of a pandemic, which exists in the hospital and in the community. I'm instructed by the lessons of the Henry Street settlement of the 1890s in New York City, where progressive nurses and social workers began to understand that to get our arms around public health in urban settings, they had to be present in the community. And so some of the great advances that happened with polio, all the things were really stood up collectively and kick the ass of the disease, were a consequence of this enlightened consciousness driven by female nurses for the most part, that they needed to be present in the lives of working families and immigrants. That transformed public health in America. That infrastructure was permitted to deteriorate. There's some residual effort of it, but right now, we really need to redouble those efforts to one, hold the line in the hospitals, but advance this consciousness into the community to heal the community where the disease also resides and is being transmitted, even as we attempt to deal with it in the hospitals.
Okay, so tell me what you mean by that. Give me a roadmap. What are you describing
right.
that you think we need these people to be doing that
right.
you think either is not being done or is not being covered that needs more support? Let me just say something. Today, which was actually yesterday, because we tape a day before, we interviewed Harold Meyerson
right.
from the American Prospect. And Harold was talking about the fact that New York City, Bill de Blasio, is doing something quite remarkable. And what Bill de Blasio is doing is he's decided to feed everyone.
Right.
And that at all the sites around the city, where historically what was going to happen was, you know, the public school kids who are now not in public school, but public schools were more important than just education. It was where they got fed.
Right.
And so initially what they said is, we're still going to feed you.
Right.
And all of a sudden he realized, wait a minute. It's not just the kids that need to be fed.
Right.
It's families that need to be fed.
Right. And
it's not just the parents that need to be fed. It's people in New York City because everything is not happening like this. The
right.
checks have disappeared. The income has disappeared, but the hunger hasn't disappeared.
Right.
So he is now opening these facilities or
right.
making the food available to anyone. They're not going to ask where you live. They're just going to say, if you are hungry, you can get food here.
Right.
That is pretty remarkable. Is that an example, Bob?
That's exactly an example. And it's being proactive and getting ahead of the curve of the circumstance. And so most importantly, the entire nation is fixating on the data points that Governor Cuomo brings out each day. So he will tell you how many deaths there are. The same protocol is observed by the other governors, and it's usually followed by Governor Murphy in New Jersey. And so they'll say total deaths today. That is an inaccurate statement, because what's happening is there are hundreds of deaths, if you accumulate it around the country, no doubt tens of thousands of deaths, that are happening in people's homes. And the failure to account for that means we do not have situational awareness about the scope and scale of this pandemic. And continuing to ignore it permits it to proliferate as our government, particularly the federal government, often acts more like a predator than a helper.
But Bob, one of the things we keep hearing about, and that's what I thought the mantra for the test, is that right now, part of the problem is because it is so difficult to access a test, that you have to be a privileged person to get a test, that you have to have some access to a healthcare system that maybe you've never had access to get a test. So who's being tested is still kind of this discrete, almost elite group, or someone who's, you know.
And ironically, that's exactly the wrong group of people. I just got off the phone with John Samuelson.
Okay.
Leads the Transportation Workers Union International. They represent transit and airline workers and 160,000 workers across the country. What's emerging is that the reality is, for the public health purpose of staunching this epidemic, is that the most lowest paid essential worker needs to, one, be tested, and to have PPEs, not as a consequence of some altruistic utopian revival of the New Testament, but as a fundamental principle of public health.
This is so interesting. So my daughter lives in China. We've been having this discussion about masks. And of course, in China, everybody has masks. I mean, my daughter had like 7 or 8 different kinds of masks, depending on the kind of pollution in Shanghai. Right. And now, because of the pandemic, it's not like it's new for them. It's always been part of the fabric of their society. Right. But the idea that so many people would need them because of the pandemic has put a lot of pressure on China to sort of, you know, make more and keep them because they are fighting their own pandemic. Well, my daughter decided that she was able to get me 50 masks. I said, I don't want masks. She said, I'm sending you masks. So guess what? Yesterday, 50 masks came in the mail for my daughter in China.
N95?
No, just
okay, I want to know what you're rolling with.
No, not N95. But here's
what I did. Doesn't love you that much.
No, not yet anyway. Maybe never. But anyway, so here's what I did, Bob. I called the fire department and the EMTs. And I said, do you guys need masks? And they went, oh God, yes. Is the box open? I said, no. And I said, they're on my porch. Come over and get them.
Excellent.
So not only have you taught me well, I realized that where do the masks belong? But they belong in the places where it's the public transit workers, it's the fire department, it's the EMTs. It's
grocery store.
The grocery store. That was what I did. And literally a fire truck came to the house and picked them up. They were on the porch. Okay.
That's right. And so, but now the problem is that what you're seeing is when after Governor Cuomo gives his very clear address, which is these numbers related to, so let me talk about the reality I know. Okay.
Okay.
So 24/7. And my wife and I are taking in all of these reports from these workers who are actually handling the bodies, which is underreported. Occasionally, MSNBC will throw a picture. Isn't that quaint? But to be present with them, to speak with them, is a whole other experience. And so EMTs, FDNY, there are two principal unions. Local 3621 is officers and senior kind of folks who've been around a while. And then Local 2507 is about 4,000 EMTs, EMS, fire inspectors, and dispatchers. They're the people that have to go out into the community and have always really been the essential healthcare for undocumented folks, working class folks, people that don't have a relationship with a primary care physician or who don't want to go to the hospital. Now they're going out, and what they're seeing, as the governor describes the plateau, he looks at three indicia, right? He looks at the people admitted to the emergency room, to the hospital, how many people are going into intensive care unit, and how many are intubated. See, we all know that now. Yeah. And then he'll say, oh, and by the way, there's higher deaths, but that's a lagging indicator. And collectively, everyone in all the control rooms of all the major media breathes a sigh of relief and says, oh, we're bending the curve. Aren't we doing well? Meanwhile, in a parallel reality called the neighborhoods, they're having, on average, well over 200 fatal cardiacs in people's homes.
Yeah.
When they used to have 20 to 30 a day.
Say that number again. So tell me how you got that number. So what you did was you were talking to the EMTs and the firefighters.
Right, right.
So tell me about this. Okay.
We're present with them in social media, on Twitter during the weekend. They say, I can't believe, Bob, I just did 20 cardiac cases most of them fatal. I've done one or two in my in a shift that was a record, and these, some of these people have been around for 20 years on the job.
Right.
So then to credit Frank Dwyer, who's a public information guy at FDNY, being transparent, I said, not for nothing, I'm hearing from the workforce that this is blowing up, that they can't, because they have 6,500 calls a day. It's blowing off the doors of everything. There's no way that matrix that they're experiencing isn't being factored into the numbers being reported out by the state. And so this creates a parallel narrative. So they're experiencing, like I say, one of the things that happens is, on average, you have 1 to 2 cardiac arrest cases. Back in 2019, what Dwyer gave me from FDNY was a chart that showed from April 5th back 8 days in March of 2019. What you saw was a kind of range of 20 to 30 fatals in a universe of 50 to 60 cardiac calls. Not bad odds, right? I mean, when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what has happened in the same period of time is 300 calls a day and over 200 fatalities in the field.
Oh my God.
That one in Deesha. So there's no way. Now, the problem here is that from a scientific standpoint, we do not know that they're COVID positive. You can make a surmisal. That's not empirical science. But all I would beg our leadership and Rachel Maddow and the rest of the Illuminati to do is, when you use these numbers, just please put the asterisk in. We know that people are dying at home. Be present with the circumstance of humanity.
Let me sort of mirror back what you're saying so I completely understand it. Because one of the things that we heard was that they were being told that the EMTs, that if you went to a call and someone had cardiac arrest and they didn't have a pulse, that you were not to try to resuscitate, that basically you were to assume they're dead. Okay. And where before they might have, I mean, they may do a little bit of something, but there's the normal response is no longer normal, and that you basically sort of assume that they're going
to
be.
I have to qualify a little bit. You almost got that right. I give you a 95, right. But the 5% right. That's important is the standing still order is to do everything available on the rig, and they've got some tricks in their bag. So
right.
Anything they can do, they'll do it with the full oomph that they always did. What they can't do is once they're not able to raise you back up to a pulse on your own, then they are pronouncing you dead. What's problematic is that historically, there used to be something called, like, I think, the Guardian Angel Breakfast, where we would go as a lovely, and God, it makes me almost want to cry thinking about it, where you'd be in a room, a big banquet hall, with 20 to 30 people from all walks of life that EMT saved exactly at that point, but going to the hospital.
Yeah.
And the ritual was you got a little thing, you got a little plaque, you met the guy or gal you saved. And so what's happening, though, is that, and this is the emotional problem for EMTs, is they've taken an oath to do that. That's right. The standard they're used to.
Right.
And because of the lack of preparation of our society and the blindness of Caliglia in the White House, they're being forced to live this failure that is going to produce PTSD for sure.
Then this makes sense in some ways, because then these deaths become invisible as we're talking about the pandemic. If you actually follow the new orders that they're being given, right. It's not like this isn't being driven possibly by COVID-19 or the pandemic. It's that they don't even want to know, and they don't want to sort of account
right.
for those deaths.
Well, and now,
so that's the problem. So the problem is it's an invisible number. It's an invisible face. It's an invisible body. And that is not fair, because that, as you point out, doesn't represent what's actually happening in the community.
Right. And so as a consequence, then you can feel the momentum of the Blank Fiends and the Goldman Sachs going back to work, because we have this idea we've managed the problem, we've managed the facility, but the pandemic is continuing. And the numbers, you talk about death being a lagging indicator. Well, if it's your grandma that's in the front room that's dead, you have more than a lagging indicator. And so part of the problem here is also what the EMTs were concerned about was, is anyone issuing a public health message that's, as what do the experts say, something that's culturally relevant in terms of that people know the nature of the body and the risks that are implicit in any kind of thing that primordial that your ancestors did in terms of embracing them. I mean, part of what's happened here from an anthropological standpoint is a disruption of every norm, whether you be a Muslim, whether you be a Jew or a Christian, because that whole tradition whether it be sitting Shiva, all of that has been disrupted in a profound way. And any kind of planning that's going to be real and to the challenge has to account for that. And so there's a whole host of things. They just basically also want to see the experience of the community reflected in the planning. Because one of the problems is that it's going to continue to spread until the politicians understand and the media understands it's not a hospital problem. Our communities are sick.
How do we address that? Do we address that by insisting that if someone ends up deceased, you can't revive them? Therefore, you've been told not to bring them to the hospital,
right?
But you could test them. And you test them at that point in time. They may be deceased. That's not a reason not to test. In fact, that's more of a reason.
Exactly, sister. That's the point.
I gotcha. And who's telling that story?
Well, we're doing it to Chief, because one of the things that happened is that what the EMTs want is, because they're risking exposure. I mean, the problem
is, of course.
But as a top epidemiologist told me, the tragedy is that these people will die and their bodies will be destroyed. And just like the census, think about the census, the liberal left wants, gotta be counted, census counts, don't be left out. It's the same thing in death.
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right. They've been telling you this. The FDNY understands this.
Right.
Who can get to the bully pulpit? Who can get to MSNBC? Who can get to a damn New York Times reporter? Not that the chief leader isn't incredible.
Right. We're obscure and we're proud.
But more importantly, it is a critical piece of the story which tells you real information, not this sort of whitewashed, whitewashed information.
Right.
And here we are talking about, oh my God, look at how many, you know, people of color that have died in Milwaukee County. Oh my God, look at this.
Right.
That doesn't even come close to the story you're telling me,
right?
Because that story would really blow the numbers up.
It's operational. I mean, the other thing too is that to understand this thing, to get ahead of it, and Cuomo has said this about how this disease has been kicking our ass and been reactive. In essence, I'm upping the ante here by saying, get outside of the hospital, because the thing you want to do is begin to slow the panic flow. The other thing that's happened, and this is going to be a consequence, the death numbers that we're talking about in people's homes, as a consequence of a few other things. One is, you may be someone that feels chest pains and that should go, that's high risk, but you're not inclined to do so because of COVID. And so there's also a whole host of comorbidities, asthma, diabetes, where you're in crisis and then you won't want to go. And so then you end up succumbing to that disease. The other challenge here, looking down the road, is people are going to be terrified of hospitals for a long time. So we have to reinvent the entire way we deliver medicine. That's why the next thing that comes out of whatever Pelosi and the rest of these people do has to be a standing up of a community-based mobile EMS health service for this nation. There's no other priority.
Wow.
Because people are going to be terrified for a generation of going to those places.
Well, in a lot of ways, it's what I'm hearing. I mean, it's so interesting that you should say this. We did a story a couple of days ago about food deserts, you know, the fact, and one of the farmers I was talking to said, well, you know what we're doing? We're bringing the food to the food deserts. We're taking over a bus and we're bringing the food to them. They're not coming to the grocery store because it doesn't exist. They're not coming to the farmer's market because it doesn't exist. So we are coming to them.
Right.
We are delivering it to their community. And what you are now saying is that concept of the farmers bringing it right to that community is what's going to have to happen with healthcare.
Right. And the other issue here is that what we risk is we got into this position. It's very important to say that when people say they didn't see it coming, the reality is we spoke about this before COVID. We had 3 years of declining life expectancy in a compassionate country that wasn't delusional and run by greedy financial interests. We would have said, huh, look at, I see something on my community health dashboard that indicates a problem.
Right.
And so that is a piece of this now, because we were an unhealthy and increasingly sicker nation with worse acuities. Talk to any of your healthcare professionals on the front lines, and nurses were seeing sicker people in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get the nature of our circumstance is a consequence of bad choices in the past. And by continuing to ignore the deaths in isolation in our parlors and in our communities, we continue the same blind spots, which will ironically make us more vulnerable to this pandemic and future such challenges.
What are we doing to protect these EMTs, these firefighters, these public transit workers. I believe you had an article about the first public transit worker that died.
Right, now it's 30.
Now it's
33.
Oh my God. There was a story in New Hampshire the other day that 26% of the COVID positive patients in New Hampshire turned out to be healthcare workers.
Right.
26%.
Right.
And I'm thinking of all the people that the number should be 5%. They're the ones that have access, I thought, to the N95s. That
well,
have access.
Address. Remember, that's very important. In the 9/11 commission that must be had, the equivalent, we talked about the New York Nurses Association, the union again, flagged on March 11th that the CDC was watering down the N95 requirement that you had to have one N95 per encounter in a clinical setting, and they watered that down. And the nurses said, what did they say? Oh, the union said, the righteous sister said, we will be coming contaminated and infecting the population.
Right,
and that's what happened. Second case in point was the fire department, FDNY, told any EMT who had an encounter with a COVID positive person to go home, quit the shift, and not work for 2 weeks, even though they were asymptomatic. Now the CDC and state health boards trying to manage to the supply again, because that N95 directive was driven by not public health concerns, but managing the miserable inventory that the federal government had. Same thing's true with the workforce. So now they say you have to only be symptomatic will keep you from the job, which meant that this expedient approach has spread the disease.
Before I let you go,
yes.
Let's assume that we're going to see an expansion of testing.
Right.
Are we going to be able to sort of triage this expansion and understand where it needs to actually go next? And it's not to necessarily even just the people that are coming into the hospitals, but it is those EMTs. It is those firefighters. It is those public sector workers.
Right.
It is those grocery. I mean, the thing that I always remember is my daughter. I mean, again, I had the Chinese experience of COVID, and now I have this experience.
Right.
They are very aware of who needs. I mean, every single person that gets on a freaking subway in China has their temperature taken. They looked at the base. And they looked at who had the most contact. And that's where they started.
That's
they didn't start
the
at the top. They started at the base.
Exactly. And so the important thing would be to make sure that, and some councilmen are getting it, some local political officials are getting it, but this has to be really a rejiggering of the response and flipping the pyramid. So
yes.
From now on, we have to have some reconnaissance about the number of deaths that are happening. We don't have to say, out of respect to science, we wouldn't attribute it to necessarily COVID, but say these are the deaths that happened overnight. So also workers can begin to manage their own risk because of transparent understanding of what's going on.
And as we point out, those at the top of the pyramid, not only do they have access to care, not only are they probably more of the elite, not only do they probably have better food, they probably even, I mean, they have a better shot at survival.
Right, they can work from home.
Exactly, those at the bottom who really need to be tested, who are actually holding up the underpinnings
right.
of both our economy and our response,
right.
they're the ones that are being put at the back of the bus.
Right.
But it's like, literally, from a public transportation, they're driving the bus. And
right.
they're driving the bus. And I think you're absolutely right, Bob. Nobody talks about this. We always talk about, you're absolutely right, the hospitals, the admittances, the deaths, those that have access to testing. And it turns out, guess what? It isn't the people that you're writing about, and it isn't the people that you're covering, and
right.
it isn't the stories that we must have.
Right.
Because if we don't understand those stories, we continue to fail.
Right.
Thank you, because once again, this is important, and you never know who's listening to us, as you know, you
right.
write from Salon.com and the Chief Leader and
right.
at Stuck Nation, and we throw it out into the ether.
Right.
Every once in a while, the right person hears it, and all of a sudden they follow that story.
Well, even if it has an impact on people understanding their circumstance they're in and holding their local officials accountable with this insight, it's worthwhile.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, sister.
Appreciate it. All right. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, Stephanie Collins, and Dave Scott produce the show. We'll talk to you tomorrow. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Change. Just-